When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to the Second Chance Podcast. I'm Raphael Rowe, your host. This show centres around the question of who deserves a second chance, who has the power to grant it, and what it means. Our guests come from diverse backgrounds and experiences, including those who have received second chances and those who some might feel are undeserving. We'll also be looking at how a person's journey can lead them to a second chance. Colin Sutton, a former police detective, is celebrated for his instrumental role in the capture of two of the UK's most notorious criminals, Levi Belfield, a serial killer, and Delroy Grant, a serial rapist, were both caught thanks to his exceptional efforts. The BAFTA-nominated ITV drama, Manhunt, was inspired by the successful investigations led by Colin. With over three decades of experience and a record of solving over 30 murder cases, Colin is a seasoned detective with a remarkable track record. His involvement in these two high-profile cases brought him widespread recognition. In Manhunt, DCI Sutton is portrayed by Martin Clunes as the lead investigator who brought both criminals to justice. Colin's book, Manhunt, provides a comprehensive insight into his methods and strategies. I had the pleasure of meeting Colin earlier this year at CrimeCon, where we discussed his exceptional work as a detective in front of a live audience. We also talked about his challenges and fame that came with his exceptional career, as well as the second chance he gave to the victims of crimes he helped solve. Thank you very much, Chris. Now, we've kind of framed this as the Second Chance Podcast. That's my podcast, Second Chance Podcast. And if you haven't listened to it, we've got a YouTube channel, we've got an audio version, and it's really me talking to people about their second chances in life and what that means to people, who gives people a second chance. Do people deserve a second chance in life, whether you are a victim, a perpetrator, etc., etc.? So if you haven't listened to it, have a listen. I'm very fortunate to meet Colin here. And I should say at the very outset, Colin, so many people have come up to me and sort of said, oh, you're doing an interview with Colin. I'm such a big fan. I want to squeeze his cheeks. I want to I want to marry him. You know, so look, there's hands up over there offering themselves. Colin, how do you respond to that immediately?
Three wives have been enough in my experience. It's actually a second chance in some ways, but it's a nice second chance for me because I had a career and did what I did, and I was delivering flowers for £8 an hour when I finished just to occupy myself. And all this suddenly happened, and I just roll with it and do what I can with it. And
you say roll with it, but you are a phenomenal individual. I mean, let's go. I like to start my podcast with all of my guests by asking them who they are, as opposed to what's been written about them, what people have read about that individual, the headlines in particular, the cases that you've been involved in, which we will get into, which most of you in this room know about, Levi Belfield, the Night Stalker, and I'm sure they want to hear a little bit about that if you haven't before. But before we go there, who is Colin Sutton? Because, I mean, your career as a police officer goes way back, and I read this on Wikipedia this morning, 1957.
I'm not that old, for God's sake.
So Wikipedia, don't believe
Wikipedia, right? This is really quite hilarious. There's a guy called Colin Bertie, in inverted commas, his nickname Sutton, who joined the police in 1957, was in Leicestershire, and then came to the Met as an assistant commissioner or something. And he died in 1994. And for some reason, his Wikipedia entry has got a picture of me. and we're kind of being merged into one. And the production company I do all the Real Hunter stuff for, they sort of saying, you need a Wikipedia entry, we're going to sort it. And Wikipedia won't have it. Nope, we're not correcting it. You can't correct it. They correct it, it gets corrected or decorrected back. And forever, I am joined the police 4 years before I was born. And I died 29 years ago, and here I am.
Well, there you go. That's why it's really important, right, that we start at where I want to start at, which is, when did you become a police officer, and why did you become a police officer?
I became a police officer in 1981, at the beginning of 1981. My dad was a cop. My mum was a lawyer. My grandfather's drove a bus, and one was in the army. My great-grandfather was a police officer in the Met. In fact, my great-grandfather, my father and I all started at the same police station, which was Tottenham in North London. My great-grandfather was invalided out in 1921, having been run over by a horse-drawn tram on point duty outside the police station. And he got a pension of £76 a year. I looked all this up in the Met History section. And of course, now my son is a sergeant in South West London, so there's 4 out of 5 generations. I always wanted to do it. Mum and Dad didn't want me to do it, didn't want to be a policeman. They wanted me to be a lawyer. For various reasons, I managed to persuade them otherwise and joined the police. I was 20, 1981, and went to Tottenham and didn't know what I wanted to be other than a street policeman. I didn't want to be a detective. Did not want to be. My dad had tried to be a detective, and he was somewhere he shouldn't have been or wasn't somewhere he should have been and got busted, and he ended up as traffic cop for most of his service, and they hate the CID detectives. Mostly, and they're all bent. You don't want to get involved with them. And I just wanted to be a good street cop. And Tottenham was a tough place. I was a community officer on the Boardwater Farm Estate before the riot, and that was a tough gig. You know, that was difficult policing in those days. And one of the pieces of advice my dad gave me, which I passed on to my son, was if they ever offer you a training opportunity or a course, take it. Yeah, don't ever turn anything down. And I'd done all right at school and so forth, and I was quite unusual in having A-levels joining the police in those days. And I did the probation's exam after I had about 20 months service and passed it quite well. And the superintendent said, do you want to take the sergeant's exam in January? And I hadn't thought of it, but I said, well, yeah, if you'll let me, sir. And I had 2 years and 3 days service. I passed the exam. I got onto a promotion course thing, which kept me in uniform. And I'd wanted then, because something had happened where I'd come across a double murder off duty and tried to rescue, it was a fire, an arson, and tried to rescue the people there and failed and they'd died. But I'd been on the murder squad for a few days and I'd seen this guy sitting with a sea of people in front of him, much like this, and saying, okay, what do you do today? What does it mean? What do we do next? What have you done today? And that kind of intellectual process really appealed to me. I thought, God, I want that job. That's what I want to do. That's a great job. But I thought, I can't do it. I'm on this career path. So I went to Bramshill to the police college for a year. I was a uniform sergeant at Paddington for a year. Then got promoted to inspector at Leighton in East London. I was 25 years old. I had 4 years and 10 months police service. I knew nothing. How I coped, God only knows. And what I learned then was actually, if you don't know the answer, you ask. You don't pretend you know the answer because you just come unstuck that way. And then because I'd gone to university and given up to join the police, they'd sent me back and said, do you want to go and do a law degree now? I said, yeah, okay. So I did a law degree at UCL, 3 years full-time on full inspector's pay, which was a good gig, really, in fairness. eight hours a week lectures, 3 of tutorials, football, cricket. Yeah, it was good. And I got my handicap down to, I think, its lowest ever then, which was 12.
That's golf, if
yeah.
you don't know.
That was great. And then I was never going to be a detective. And I was a uniform inspector at Holloway in North London for a long time, for about 4 years, and loved it. It was really tough work and a really great, best team of people I think I ever worked with doing the response policing in Holloway. And they had a moratorium on promotions in the Met for 4 years, and they said to people like me who'd been on this promotion scheme, well, we can't promote you, so do you fancy doing something different? I said, can I be a detective? They said, yeah, all right. And that was it. That was how I became a detective. But I went straight across the DI and kind of took to it and found my niche. It's something I said to my son, was that, you know, you will find your niche in the police and it may take you 2 years or 20 years, but once you find it, hold on to it because it means a lot. And if you're going to work every day and love what you're doing, you've got you're luckier than most people.
Do you know what I find interesting when you said it was just a job? But what you're dealing with is human beings, and some of the most frightening, some of the most traumatized human beings. How do you separate being a police officer who's got to investigate, you know, murders, and we know that you've investigated some of the most high-profile murders, but how do you separate? Because someone said to me just a moment ago, one thing about Colin, he has such compassion, empathy, sympathy, even today. And as a police officer who's been involved in these deep, dark crimes, you still come out and don't have that kind of thing that some police officers have. So how do you separate the job from dealing with people who are going through the most traumatic experience in their lives, whether it's victims or perpetrators that you are accusing of a crime?
Can I? I'll start at the first. I'm looking around. Are there any police officers or ex-police officers in the room? No? Yes? No? I don't really like policemen very much. That's the truth. Police women over the years I've got on very well with, and they have different views. No, come on. No, it's They have a softer attitude. They don't have such a sort of macho attitude, and that's
I beg to differ.
That's not really me. Well, okay, I'm generalising, but yeah, I think policing, and particularly even more so, detective work is about people. It's about understanding people. It's about understanding why people did things, what they did, what would they have done. You know, you're testing theories, and you're trying to look at it, and if you unless you understand how people operate and how people think and how they react, then that, you know, unless you can do that, you've not really got a chance of second guessing what they're doing or looking at what they're doing. So I think there's that to it. Liam said something in your session earlier on that was really, really interesting, where he said you've got two, there's some people you ask, why did you become a policeman? You become a policeman to lock up the bad guys, or did you become a policewoman to help the community, help people, and to do that side of it? And I'm very much that side, yeah. And locking up people like Levi Belfield or Delroy Grant, does that help the community? Well, yeah, because, you know, in both cases, there are literally dozens and dozens of potential victims who would otherwise have been victimised, who can't be and weren't, because these people were in prison. So, you know, you've done your job in that way. So for me, it's more that aspect of protection than it is the aspect of sort of punitive action against somebody who's transgressed. And that's why, yeah, perhaps unusually, I think, for police officers generally, and I don't know, my generation, firmly, firmly, firmly against the death penalty. Because I don't think that's what a civilised society should do to people. But I'm in a minority in the police service, I think, certainly at the lower ranks in that, and possibly in population as a whole, but that's, and I'd have found it difficult doing the job knowing that was going to be the outcome.
Even when you're dealing with people like Levi Belfield or Delroy Grant,
I play these, I'm a bit of a Muhammad Ali, I do this sort of future history where I sort of play things through in my head as to how things are going to go, and one of those that I've prepared for is that hopefully I survive longer than Levi Belfield does, and if he dies in prison, I'm going to get a phone call from journalists saying, what's your comment? And I'd never gloat. I'd never say I'm glad he's dead. I'll say I think few will mourn him, but I don't wish the death of another person on anybody, because that's just not who I am.
Chris described you as a legend. what made that legacy? We know your involvement in the Belfield case, we know your involvement in the Grant case, but you've been involved in numerous investigations, cases where people have been locked up who didn't get those sorts of headlines. What makes you the legend you are, people describe?
I was just lucky, really. Just, you know, and I don't say that tongue-in-cheek. I stepped up when things happened, but somebody else might have stepped up or might not have done.
But is it because you had a certain skill set that other detectives didn't have?
I don't think in terms of being a detective. I think in terms of getting the best out of the people that I worked with. I think that's the most important thing. Knowing who was the right person to do that job. Understanding how people think, how people operate. How does the team operate? You know, I've said it before to other people, sort of off the record, but there was one officer on my murder team. Every single time this officer, and I'm being deliberately sort of gender neutral, every time this officer spoke to a member of the public, I'd get a complaint, either by a letter, an email, or a phone call, because they didn't have those skills. but you put them down in front of CCTV and they did a blinding job. And so I sat down with him, said, look, well, it gave it away there, him. I sat down with him and said, look, you know, I'm fed up with answering all these complaints about how you talk to people. You're not good at it, but you're brilliant at CCTV. Now, two things. You can either be CCTV for virtually everything we ever do and stay here, or you can go back to a borough. Because, you know, I don't want you on my team if you're going to be like that. He said, well, no, I want to stay. I'll do that. And he did a great job. So it was a square peg put into the square hole. And it's kind of understanding that. And being, they knew where they were with me. They knew that if I said something, it happened. It was true. It was going to happen. That's so important. You can't work for somebody who you can't trust. So I think it's all those things that I didn't. It wasn't so much my great skill as a detective. I like to think I'm quite good at thinking things through. But it's much more important to understand that you're a leader of a team. And I don't solve things on my own. They solve it for me. I set the strategy. I try and support them and get the best out of them. That's what I think leadership's about. It's getting the best out of the people you lead.
I just wanted to let you know that the Second Chance podcast is also available for viewing on our YouTube channel at Second Chance Podcast. So if you want to enhance your listening experience with the visuals, check it out. I also wanted to ask for your support to help me grow this podcast. All you have to do is click on the subscribe, follow and like buttons wherever you listen to the Second Chance Podcast. If you can spare another few minutes to comment and rate the show, that would be brilliant. By doing so, you'll be assisting us in bringing in more guests and creating more content for the show. It only takes a second, but it makes all the difference. Thank you.
I've spent a lot of my career, as people here will know, working on the other side, you know, as a former prisoner myself, wrongfully imprisoned, going into prisons for my Netflix series, interviewing serial killers and various other people that people like you lock away. Mm. And I ask that big question, do they deserve a second chance? Do they deserve to be executed, or do they deserve an opportunity of having a second chance in life, being released from prison? What do you think from your side? You know, when you look at people like Belfield and you look at people like the Night Stalker, are these individuals that after 20, 25 years, 30 years in prison, do they deserve an opportunity to live a second life?
I think if you are an academic and looking at it in a kind of sterile atmosphere, a sterile sort of environment of academia, then logic and decency says yes. I think in the real world, and I don't like that phrase much, but in the context of a community, there are certain people that to do that and give them that second chance would be such an affront to the community that perhaps they shouldn't have it.
But is that because the individual hasn't been, and I hesitate to use the word rehabilitated, because, you know, 20, 30 years in prison, people do change. Not everybody, and I don't know if Belfield and the Night Stalker are those kinds of individuals, or many of the other people that you... But I mean, should we be appeasing a community rather than what justice should look like and these second chances?
There's a balance, isn't there, between the rights and needs of an individual and the rights and needs of the wider community. And yeah, do I think anyone can be rehabilitated? Yes, in theory, they can. Does it happen very often? I'm not sure, but, you know, John McVicar and, you know, the sort of people who have gone on to have stellar careers, academic careers or whatever, having been quite serious and heavy criminals in the past. But they're quite, you know, I can't think of another one off the top of my head. He's the first one that comes to mind. But so, you know, can someone like Levi Belfield ever be rehabilitated? Well, the evidence I think we see so far is that even from behind bars, he is still managing to pull strings, to ring bells, to cause mayhem for the victims' families that he's already taken someone from. And while he's still doing that, then I don't think we can say he's rehabilitated. And I don't think the community as a whole would accept him being put back amongst them.
I during the years that I was in prison, I became very good close friends with Reggie Cray, one of the Cray twins. He'd been in prison for 35 years, you know, became a close friend of mine, prison close friend that is. In the 35 years that he'd been in prison before he died as a prisoner, although he died in the hospital outside, There was an argument about whether he should or shouldn't be released. They're having the same argument about Charles Bronson at the moment. Should people be released from prison who have been rehabilitated? Because I'm just trying to see it from your perspective. When you're sitting across that individual in an interview room, and then 15, 20, 30 years down the line, they're no longer a threat to the community. And I don't believe Reggie Craig was. He had this notoriety around him and this mythical idea that he was still what he was. But believe me, he was not. He was a differing old man at 35 years old who couldn't string together a proper sentence. That's what prison had done to him. It fragmented his mind and he was unable to articulate himself very well. Do you believe they should?
Yeah, I think my personal sense is that we shouldn't be keeping people whose faculties have deteriorated to that condition and who don't pose danger. We shouldn't be keeping them in prison. But, you know, you then go back to the fact that, yeah, there are victims and victims' families who that means a lot to. I talked to a lady in the series we're just making of The Real Manhunter who has lost her daughter, murdered. Somebody's been convicted of it. And I won't tell you the case because it's Danielle Jones, if you know the case, yeah? Talking to Linda, her mother, who's fantastic and talks at any opportunity because she says, I do this because every single time I can get a platform, it keeps my daughter's memory in the public eye. Do you know that the guy, I forget his name now, I ought to know it, but I haven't got an auto cue. No, I don't use an auto cue. I can't think of his name, but he was her uncle. He was like married to her mother's sister or father's sister. And he was convicted. He's in prison, but he served the time that the judge allotted him before he could apply for parole. So annually, he applies for parole. Now, he hasn't told the location of the body. So sort of Helen's Law comes into play, if you like, with it, yeah? But think of it from this point, from the mother's point of view. Every year in about March, she gets a phone call from the parole board saying, he's up for parole soon. We'll be hearing it in the week, next week or two, and then we'll be in touch. And it can be 3, 4, 5, or 6 weeks before she gets the phone saying, no, he didn't get it. And she says to me, when I sit and interview her, she says, I'm on pins. We're all on pins for that 6 weeks while we're waiting. And the thing to me is that I know for all the many faults that the police service in this country have, and I'm not blind to them, I'm really not, I promise you. One thing that we've managed to do well since I started in 1981 to now is family liaison and family liaison officers, and we do a really good job of it. The CPS and the parole board are light years behind, because if that woman doesn't deserve some support and better treatment than having to sit and wait for 6 weeks to know whether her daughter's killer is going to be released from prison, yeah, we're better than that. We ought to be better than that.
I think there's always two sides. I mean, that parole show that was on the BBC recently gives another insight into how they operate. You've had a very distinguished career. In that time, have you been involved in any cases that have been miscarriages of justice? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I believe I have. Or I believed I have. And it's, obviously... I don't know, people, I'm sort of a late substitute for this, aren't I? There was somebody else coming in, but I said, no, I'll do it. I talk about anything. But, so I thought about this. And I think it's not a plug, because I've had enough 28 pences for my books. But in my second book, there's, I think I tell this story. When we were doing disclosure for the Night Stalker case, the officer that was doing it, he was... very sharp and very on the ball. She came to me and she said, there's a case here that from 1987, so that's like 9 years before the Night Stalker case started. No, 5 years before we thought they started. And it looks like one of our cases, an 88-year-old woman who's got somebody broken into a house and raped her.
Oh.
Okay, so I try and get the file, and when I get the file, it's not there. They say it's out with the cold case sexual offences team at Sutton or something. So I phone them up. And I said, oh, don't you worry about that, Governor. We've got someone for that. I think no, that's exactly what I'm worrying about. Because obviously part of our case against Derek Grant is sort of system and they're all the same. And I said, no, that's exactly what I was worried about. He said, oh, there's DNA. So I said, well, who is it? And he says, and he gives me the name. And it's an obviously Irish name. And I said, right, okay. I said, but this woman said she was raped by a black man. He said, yeah, but there's DNA. Okay, but And I looked at the statements eventually, and this guy, she's saying, this lady who's now dead and can't tell the story, is saying that it was a black man with short afro hair and with a South London stroke Jamaican accent raped me. And there was another man in the room about possibly who was also black. And they've got a 6'3" ginger-haired Irishman whose DNA is on her window frame.
Matches the description perfectly. Right?
So I'm thinking, well, this is a bit odd. Anyway, I thought no more of it because I think, well, that's okay. It's not. It doesn't apply. You know, it's not going to trouble our case because we've got DNA and forensics anyway. And then the next I hear, I get a phone call from media branch who say, would you like to make a comment about this John Joseph McLean getting 14 years for rape? And I said, no, I really don't want to make any comment about it at all because I'm shocked by it and I'm really worried by it. So I went to a senior officer, more senior than me then, and explained the situation. I said, I don't know how this man's been convicted, but we looked... Subsequently, I've looked at all the papers after I retired because I spoke to his solicitors and the judge essentially had directed the jury to say, well, she was probably mistaken. And that was it. And he got 14 years. And I'm really concerned about it. So I said, go to this boss. I said, look, you know, this is the circumstance. These are the circumstances. I'm really concerned about this. I think we ought to get somebody to take a look at it. And he said, Colin, we're the police. We put people in prison. We don't let them out. And then I went to the CPS and I said, I'm really worried about this. And they just said, properly convicted before a judge, we're not bothered about it.
End of the story.
End of story. And so once I retired and I started working, doing a lot of work for ITV News, first of all, and they were looking at doing some documentaries. And I said about this case, I think we should have a look at it. And that's how I got in touch with his solicitors, and they came in and they gave me copies of the papers and I read through it. What I actually now realise is that this guy, his defence, if you like, was, yes, I did have sex with this lady because I like old ladies, I'm a bit weird like that. And I fixed her window and that's how I left the DNA and the fingerprints in the bedroom. And asked her neighbour, because I was going out with her as well at the same time, and she said, she's only 69, she was a spring chicken, that one. And she said, oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we met him in the tea rooms and he had a black man with him. And then I realised this guy was actually a check fraud merchant, really. He'd been last arrested in the late 90s in Leicester for check fraud, as had Delroy Grant. And suddenly the light bulb comes on and you think, hang on, I think what's happened here is probably Delroy Grant and him were both involved together.
Okay.
So maybe it wasn't a miscarriage after all. But the fact that this is a really cynical thing about the media is that this guy had a previous conviction for indecently assaulting somebody. And as soon as they found that out, they said, no audience sympathy. Even if he's doing 14 years wrongly, he's obviously a wrong one, isn't he? And they wouldn't make the programme, wouldn't do the film, because he had that previous conviction.
You've been involved in... As lots of people here will be aware, yeah. Manhunt, and you know, a lot of Clooney, is it, or someone?
Clunes, yeah. Clunes, not Clooney,
who
Jesus, no.
I'm not familiar. I haven't seen it myself. But and we don't have much time to talk about that. Any regrets? You know, a distinguished career as a police officer who's been involved in numerous cases, locking people up, doing the right thing with in the right way. Any regrets?
Yes, and a regret that only hit me in the last 6 months, and that was there's a case that I wanted to finish. And
sure, you don't want to save this for a book?
Yeah, it's half written. As I bumped into my publishing editor today out on the bookstall out there. I thought, oh, I've got to keep away from him. No, he's over there. I owe him a book. Actually, my last 10 months of my service, when I was at Lewisham and we were getting the Night Stalker ready for court, I was bored stiff. I was driving 49 miles around the M25, going in 7 hours, 58 minutes, and then driving home again because I had nothing to do. What I should have done was got the papers back for these old cases and we could have done it then. And as it was, it had to wait until 2020, so in 10 years, when I got the funding from a TV company to make a film about it. We went and did the investigation last year, filmed it as we did it, found some new evidence, gave it all back to the Met, and it's now a live inquiry again. But I could have done that 10 years before. And if I had have done, the victim's mother, who lived to 94 and only died 3 years ago, would have still been alive for it. another victim's father was still alive. And I don't know what, I think I was so pissed off because I had nothing to do that I kind of withdrew. And if I'd have had, if I had my time again, I'd say, give us those papers. I'd say, a couple of good people, and we could have gone and done it.
I've got about three minutes left because I've had that hand wave. And before I wrap up, because I know there are some super fans of Colin in this room, I want to give you the opportunity to ask just two questions. So anybody who wants to ask Colin a question about something they're interested in, raise your hand. Lady over there.
Yes.
How did you feel about that? Because
about Liam?
No, about the whole...
The case. Disclosure, every case has a disclosure officer. But very often, for volume crime, it's the investigating officer. And it's done to a greater or less degree. I said to Jeanette, who came and spoke to you afterwards, who was sitting next to me, that I had a very skewed view about disclosure because when the CPIA provisions came in, I was involved in major crime. And so I've got a great photograph of the case file, the court file for Belfield. It's on a pallet. It really is. There were 65,000 documents, and we had to do disclosure on that, and we did it. But we had the whole team, and I signed it off, and I read every single one of them. And some of those documents were 30 pages long because you just got into the habit that that's how you investigate it and that's what you had to do. The thing that scared me, I said this to Liam after, the thing that scared me about it was what if that lady had disposed of her phone 30 seconds before she went into the police station? Where's Liam there? He's straight behind the eight ball again. You know, he's. And that worries me. That worries me no end. And in some ways, that worries me even more than the fact that there was, and I think it's incompetence rather than, you know, conspiracy or cock-up. I always go for cock-up with the police because I had 30 years of it and I know what they're like. But it scares me more the fact that we are now generating more evidence with these things in our pockets than anybody can sensibly cope with. That's the truth of it. And so the provisions that we've got and the facilities we've got and the system and processes we've got aren't suited to terabyte upon terabyte of data coming out of people's pockets.
It's frightening, isn't it? But look, we don't have much more time as the seconds tick down. So I just want to say thank you to everybody coming and listening to Colin and me have this conversation. Thank you, Colin, for sharing.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Second Chance podcast. Your support is greatly appreciated. Quick reminder that you can find our video interviews on our YouTube channel at Second Chance Podcast. Please subscribe and follow us to be notified of new episodes. Please share our episodes with your friends, your family and colleagues, and follow us on YouTube and your preferred podcast platform for updates on new episodes. Your feedback is crucial to the growth of our podcast. Please rate and review our episodes and let us know your thoughts in the comments section. This podcast was brought to you by Second Chance Media Productions. Audio Avalanche handles audio editing. J-Row Productions created the original soundtrack. Studio Minerva designed the eye-catching cover. Social media marketing agency Scribble manages and creates our social media content. If you haven't already, please follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Just look for Second Chance Podcast with me, Raphael Rowe. Thanks for tuning in.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.